The Selected Shorts podcast is sponsored by Audible.com, home to over 75,000 audiobooks and more, including the Thalia Book Club and Selected Shorts series. Learn how to download a free audiobook at audible.com/symphonyspace.
From PRI, Public Radio International.
A cave opened its mouth in my heart. I knew what 20 grand was. I also knew what a Google, the largest number in the world, was. 100 zeros, but 20 grand seemed better. I saw a lifetime of unshared Happy Meals and always getting a soda with dinner at Ye Olde Tavern restaurant.
You're listening to Jane Curtin reading from Rebecca Curtis's story, 20 Grand, one of the two tales we'll hear on this edition of Selected Shorts, a series that originates in live performance on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. Two family dramas centering on mothers and daughters by young American women writers make up this program. The first story is entitled 20 Grand and was written by Rebecca Curtis. Curtis's work has been hailed in The New Yorker's debut fiction issue and has been selected for the O. Henry Prize Stories. She teaches creative writing at Columbia University. This story was read at the Westport Playhouse in a program co-presented by the Westport Arts Center. We'll hear 20 Grand, read by Jane Curtin.
On December 13, 1979, when my mother was 30 years old, she lost an old Armenian coin. That winter was cold, and she had been sleeping with my sister and me on a fold-out couch in the living room to save on heat. We lived on a cleared ledge, a natural shelf on a mountain high above a lake. The wind on the shelf was amazing. At night, it leapt up to the blinking red light at the tip of the peak behind our house, then skidded back down across the pines and whistled past our windows, somehow inserting through tiny cracks between the windows and the frame snow that sloped and sparkled on the sills. Our driveway was a dirt road that wound through a field. It was often lined by 8-foot banks, which I climbed on my way home from school, with teetering, sand-specked bucket lumps at their tops. Sporadically, a kid came with a tractor. When he left, the lane was clear. But overnight, the wind swept snow across the shelf, up over the banks and into the road. By morning, the drifts were as deep as if the driveway hadn't been plowed at all. Every day, my mother called the kid, who was slow and did the easy jobs in town first, to try to get him to come. Then she shoveled the path to the woodpile and one to the car. She barely ever looked at the coin. It was silver and heavy. On one side was a man with a craggy profile, a square crown, and one sleepy, thick-lidded eye. And on the other was a woman. The woman was voluptuous, wore a gown, and held something in her outstretched hand, maybe wheat. The coin wasn't a perfect circle, and its surface was pocked. But it had been my mother's mother's, and she kept it in her purse. On that day, she was in a foul mood. My sister was 1 1/2, and I was 6. For weeks, the sky had been a chalky gray that darkened to charcoal in the afternoon. Snowflakes were wafting onto the car. We were going to visit my father. Before we left, my mother glanced in the kitchen mirror, tucked her hair behind her ears, and said, "We're out of groceries. If we don't get some cash from your father, I don't know what we'll eat tonight." We often drove to visit him. He was a guard bum for the Air National Guard and lived 60 miles south at the base in Portsmouth, where he was on alert. Occasionally, he flew to England to pilot refuelers for the Looking Glass planes that swung along the Russian coast, but mostly he was on alert. This was temporary. He and my mother had married young, out of excitement, and spent 5 years moving around the country to wherever my father was posted. But when my mother got pregnant, they decided they needed a house. He'd switched from active duty to the guard and was stationed in New Hampshire. My mother liked Portsmouth. The sea kept the air mild. The streets in the downtown were cobblestoned, lined by shops and brass lanterns, and the university, where she could get a job or take classes, was close by. But the houses there were expensive, and my father's mother, who lived an hour north, offered my parents an acre of land for free. They drove up to the mountain. They walked across the shelf. It was summer. The hay was high, gold and flecked with Queen Anne's lace. My father asked what she thought. He said, "It's just for now." And she said, "All right." They moved all their things into his mother's house. A week later, my father began to build a bungalow with a steep roof, gingerbread trim, and a small wooden deck, like the ones he'd seen built on hills nearby. While on alert, my father lived with several hundred other men and wore a pea-green jumpsuit that, aside from the gold-zippered pockets on his calves and hips and the blue patch on his left shoulder, looked not unlike the pajamas that my sister and I wore to bed. The other men also wore the jumpsuits, except for the ones who wore navy polyester suits with stars, and they bunked alongside my father in a vast facility that, much like a high-tech rabbit warren, existed largely under the earth. The complex was surrounded by two barbed wire fences. To get inside, we had to stop at an electric gate and be checked by friendly black men wearing rifles. Then we walked, I always looked over my shoulder, down a long, dark, sloping concrete tunnel. In the bunker, we were allowed to go to the library. The room was small, gingery, and hot, with shelves of leather-bound books. On the scratchy red chairs in the narrow aisles lay magazines. They're articles about naked women or cars. Brown stuffing sprang out from the seats of the chairs and cigarettes burned in tins on their arms. The other place we could go was the rec center, which contained a foosball table, a pool table, one ball missing, two cues with broken tips, a parcheesi board, and a soda machine. The cafeteria down the hall smelled foreign and delicious. At its far end were vats of spaghetti and soupy brown sauce, inside which, I guess, was steak. Best of all, the food was free. But my mother and my sister and I were not allowed to eat it. We were not supposed to be in the warren. In fact, for more than an hour at a time. But my father sometimes sneaked us into the theater, a room with a few benches and a slide screen to watch a movie. And when I got hungry, as I always did, he'd carry me into the cafeteria, just far enough so that I could see the vats, then take me back out and ask me what I wanted so that he could order it himself and slip it to me in the library. Usually I wanted lime jello and garlic bread. My father was on base 5 or 6 days at a stretch, 4 times a month. He was often on duty at Christmas and was never sick. He was short and pale, but he had excellent posture. He admired Elvis's style and Henry Ford's business sense. When my mother burned toast, he told her not to throw it out. He ate it himself and washed it down with burnt coffee from the bottom of the pot. He was cheerful, deeply in love with my mother, and quick to get mad. However much money he left us for while he was on alert, we were careful with it, spending it until it was gone. Then on the third or fourth day of his absence, we'd drive to visit him and ask for more. He tried to get a job in town. He'd taken a position at a cement plant, but it had gone bankrupt. Next, he signed on with a stationery company, but he didn't love his boss or selling pencils, and soon he rejoined the Air Force. The work, he said, was steady. We were all healthy, so could do without benefits. He missed us, but it was neat when he got to fly the jets. The economy would swing up soon, and when it did, we'd look at all our options. My mother zipped us into our snowsuits and dragged us to her rabbit hatchback. We waited while she started it, swept the snow off, and scraped the ice from the windows. Then we wobbled down our long driveway, the engine ululating through drifts. Once we reached the bottom of the mountain, we drove on sharply twisting two-laned roads under 50-foot pines. In the distance were striped mountains, dots of skiers, lifts. After coming down from the Belknap Range, we wound along the last miles of Winnipesaukee. Passing the lake took time, and it was entertaining to imagine the elegant houses that sprawled upon its white edge as our own, and to count the trucks and the bright-colored ice shacks on its surface and predict how soon they'd fall in. After the lake was a long highway bordered by forest and then the tolls, and beyond them, my father. Each trip was thrilling, because in winter we never left the house except to go to Tillman's Discount World. We bought nothing, unless my mother saw something we needed. She'd study the item, then touch it and say, "It's all cotton, no polyester. We could use a new comforter. The old one's worn." She'd turn it, see the price, and put it back. Later she'd say, "It's a good deal. It's 70% off. Might not be here tomorrow." I'd nod. She'd say, "We don't need it. Your father would be upset." We'd walk the aisles. An hour would pass. She'd buy me a pair of jeans for school. And just as we were about to leave the store, the cart would swerve, go back to home furnishings, and she'd lift the heavy package and say firmly, "The old one has holes." At home, we had great days. She was good at cooking, sewing, and folding laundry. She could wash my sister's diapers, then bleach the tub and wash my sister in an hour flat. She did our taxes without a calculator. Sometimes she seemed quiet and marked off days on the calendar. But she also said that our life would be perfect if my father's mother didn't live next door. My grandmother lived in the only other house on the shelf, a tall white colonial. And she called often to tell my mother that once again wind or raccoons had knocked our trash cans over, or to ask when my father would be home. She'd given us land and loved my father, so she also gave advice. If his car was gone for a week, she'd tell my mother that he should work less hard or he'd get sick. If his car was in our driveway for more than 2 days, she'd call to say that he'd better get back to base, lest his supervisors realize that he wasn't necessary and fire him. In his absence, she'd sometimes appeared at our door with a gift, raspberry jam she'd canned herself. And while she drank the coffee my mother had brewed, her eyes would light on whatever was new in our house, a set of dish towels, a plastic tablecloth. And she would praise the object's beauty and ask how much the object had cost. That morning, she'd installed a snow fence in our field. My mother thought snow fences were ugly. Also, she had a theory that they caused more drift than they presented. But three men and two trucks had been in our road at 6 a.m. By the time my mother heard the drills and ran outside to ask the men what they were doing, her black hair flying in the wind, the fence was already installed. When my mother called my grandmother to say, politely, that she didn't want a snow fence, my grandmother said, "I know you don't, Anna. It's for him." And hung up. My mother looked at the phone, put it back on the hook, looked in the fridge and saw that, except for some leftover meatloaf, we were out of food. She turned to me and said, "She should have asked." I nodded. "Your grandmother," she said, "does not respect our privacy." I nodded again. But secretly, I admired my grandmother because she read me the books I liked 5 times in a row upon demand and kept crystal bowls of foil-wrapped chocolates all around her den. She also hugged me a lot, and at times she sat me down for serious talks. "Your mother spends all your father's money." "I know. I myself waited 20 years to buy a dishwasher." "I know. People should only spend what they have." "I agree. I didn't even think about a washer or a dryer. We don't have a dryer." "Your mother has ruined your father's life." "I know." "Want to play Rocco?" "Okay." "And later, take this coffee cake to your mother. She won't want it." "Do you want it?" "Yes." Then say it's for you. Okay. We drove the long stretch before the tolls. At the first toll booth, my mother used the last token in the roll between the seats. She hummed. My sister fell asleep. The snow was falling straight down so that the air seemed both white and light purple, and the firs peeked through it from along the side of the road. When the second toll booth appeared in the distance, my mother's hand moved through her purse, but she kept looking ahead. Then she passed the purse back to me. "Look in here," she said. "See if you can find some quarters." I looked. I found safety pins, a tissue, and a dinner mint. "No quarters," I said. She slowed and peered at the toll booth. "Do me a favor," she said. "Check and see if you find any under the seats." I climbed past my sister. Her head was on her shoulder, and she had thrush blobs at the edges of her mouth. I pushed my belly to the hump and reached into the dark space above each mat. Eventually, I touched a cracker with a soft, mauled edge. "Now, it's okay," my mother said. "It's all right. Come up." We pulled into the toll. My mother looked through the purse herself. Then she told the woman in the booth that she was out of money, that she was sorry, but she could pay the woman on her way back. "I'm sorry, too," the woman said. "But you can't do that." The woman was older, 60, perhaps. Her hair gray and short. Above the trim of her parka, her large face was grim, or maybe just red from the cold. My mother took a picture from her wallet and handed it up. "I'm going to see my husband," she said. "This is him. He's at the base down the road. I can get cash from him as soon as I get there, and I'll come right back." She hesitated. "You can keep the ID if you need something to hold," she said. The woman pointed toward the empty lot to the right of the tolls. My mother pleaded with the woman to the extent that she was capable of it, saying we were an hour from home, the roads were bad, she couldn't turn around now, had two kids in tow. But her pleading, more insistent than humble, just made the woman mad. The woman said that if my mother did not pull over, she would sound an alarm. My mother looked down at her lap, her lips pressed together. She seemed nonplussed. She reached into her purse, unzipped a small pocket, and removed the old coin. "Here," she said, "it's the same as a dollar." The woman stuck out her arm, took it, and grunted. For the rest of the ride, my mother did not speak. And when we arrived at the bunker, we did not go in. Instead, we stood outside the fence. I was cold, and I could see Derek, the chief guard, inside the gate, waiting to check me. I mentioned this. "You don't need to be checked," my mother said. "Yes, I do," I said. "I need to be checked." Derek smiled at me. His smile said, "We have serious business to do. I know we might not be able to do it now, but later, I will check you." At last, my father came out. He was grinning. The electric gate lifted. He ducked under and swung out his arms. My mother walked into them. Derek looked away in order to preserve our dignity, mine and his. "What's wrong?" my father said. She shook her head. We got back into the car and drove past a frozen marsh and some acres of trailers to the guest house, a yellow one-story building with a flat tar roof. Its entry consisted of a dining room, a room with a table long enough for several families to eat at, and a kitchenette with a fridge that was always empty except for the perpetually abandoned Chinese food in deteriorating, grease-soaked brown bags. Above the stove were cupboards containing sugar packets, mouse turds, and instant coffee. Down a hall were three bedrooms, each equipped with bed, nightstand, ashtray, clock radio. Typically, two or three families made use of the guest house at any one time, and the sounds of radio static floated through the hall. In the living room, two brown couches sat atop an orange rug. Behind them was a bin of toys I knew well. Plastic rabbits with foolish ink-smeared faces and stuffed bears with crusty patches on their bodies. I was dumped in the living room. My mother pulled my father into a bedroom. I turned on the TV set and set my sister in front of it. Then I slipped down the hall and sat by the bedroom door. At first I heard the usual sounds, low voices, metal legs scraping the floor, the radio. Then there was fiscal talk. My mother asked for money. He gave her a 10. She asked for 20. He told her a 10 was all he had, save for a 5 he'd set aside for himself. She said we needed groceries. You got groceries last week, he said. We need groceries for this week, she said. Here, he said. He gave her the 5. I don't want it. What will you use, she said. The food here is free, he paused. If I want a beer, he added, I'll borrow a few bucks from the guys. You have tokens? Yeah, I have a roll in my car. A sound escaped her. A sigh. My knees had fallen asleep. Intriguing Chinese food smells were coming from the kitchen. Another couple had finished their nap and heated some up. I wanted food and thought they might give me some if I asked, but was too intrigued to leave the door. I can't do it, my mother said. I can't do it anymore. Come on, Anna. I'm by myself with the girls for a week. Your mother calls every day. I go crazy. Well, why don't you just tell her when I'll be home? It's not her business. I don't know what you want me to do. You need to get another job. We tried that already. I need to see you at night. I want you to come home at night like other men. I'll apply for shorter shifts. That's not enough. They went back and forth for a while. Truly, I think he liked his job. He'd never been in a war, or only twice, and only to fly refuelers for the bombers, which meant he'd hovered beyond missile range and hardly seemed to count. Finally, she said, I spent my coin. Your coin? My mother's coin. You spent that coin? Yes, he said. I wish you hadn't spent that coin. Well, I did. Nothing. Then, why did you do that? I needed money for the toll. You said you'd never spend it. I told you I was out of money. I needed money for the toll. Silence. It was my coin, she said. I knew the coin. I knew that my mother's mother had given it to her just before she died, and that she'd died when my mother was a child. During her life, she'd worked as the superintendent at 2 apartment buildings in Watertown, Massachusetts, and had owned a corner store. She was heavy-set, kept her hair in a bun, and wore a gray wool dress and a single strand of pearls, even when collecting rent from tenants or loading coal into a furnace. She had not been home much, but she'd had a lot of friends and had loved her life. In the hospital, she gave my mother the coin and said that it was a dollar, and that if my mother kept it, she would always have a dollar in her purse. That coin was very valuable, my father said. I know, my mother said. It was money. No, Anna, that coin was worth a lot. What do you mean? I mean, it was worth a lot. How come you didn't tell me? You would have spent it. Silence. He was right. She would have spent it. Then, how do you know? A long pause. I got it evaluated. How much? 20 grand, he said. A cave opened its mouth in my heart. I knew what 20 grand was. I also knew what a Google, the largest number in the world, was. 100 zeros, but 20 grand seemed better. I saw a lifetime of unshared Happy Meals and always getting a soda with dinner at Ye Olde Tavern restaurant. I knew that with 20 grand, We couldn't have bought the ocean, but it seemed to me that we could have bought Wallace Sands, the beach we went to, and perhaps its section of the ocean, and the Isles of Shoals, which my mother was always pointing out, and which appeared from the shore as a long, humpy gray shadow on the horizon, like a whale. "You tricked me," she said. I'd heard her sound indignant before, but I'd never heard her sound indignant and justified. "You tricked me," she said again. "I didn't trick you," he said. I just didn't tell you." She said nothing. He cleared his throat. "We'll get it back." "What?" "We'll get it back." "How?" His plan unfolded. It was simple and obvious. The lady would still be at the toll booth. They'd give her a dollar or a 10 if need be and get the coin back. A discussion followed. They'd get it back. Then they'd sell it. They would. They really would. Were they partners? They were. Was my father willing to quit the military, sell the house, and move us someplace warmer and more exciting like Portsmouth? No. He wasn't sure about selling the house, but he thought we could rent it out. Maybe some skiers might want it, and use the money to rent a small place in Portsmouth. As for the guard, he said, he wouldn't mind getting out. The guard had been good to him, but he didn't want to be a guard bum forever. He knew guys who'd opened franchises, Kentucky Fried Chickens, and done well. You just need, his voice deepened, seed money and a loan. The bed creaked. If she still wanted to go to school, he said, he was willing to help her look into it. She said, I want to decorate it myself, the house. He said, I'd like a garage. Well, we have to be careful. We don't want to spend it all at once. He cleared his throat. I'd like a new couch, she said. You can have that, he said. I'd like a garage. First the move, she said. Then we'll see what's left. My father checked out on a one-hour emergency pass. We all got into my mother's car. We drove to the exit of the base, stopping at the gatehouse so that my father could show the pass to the guard. The guard was young, with blonde eyebrows and fat hands. He saw us, read the pass, and stopped smiling. He said, "Don't be late, Bill." The gate rose. We headed back the way we'd come. On the way, I saw a McDonald's. It was in a valley that we could see from the highway, a big gold M in the distance. I requested a stop. I mentioned my desire for a Happy Meal. We don't have any money, my mother said. Yes, you do, I said. You have $10. The $10 is not for Happy Meals, she said. It's for groceries. I made what I felt was a tragic sound. Just wait, she said. There's crackers in the glove compartment. No crackers, I wailed. She reached back and slapped me. The slap was weak and barely touched my skin, but I was humiliated because she was my great love. I vowed that I would never care for her again. We pulled over just before the toll booths. We parked in the shameful turnaround lot. My mother and father got out and spoke together near the car. Then they opened my door and studied my sister and me. What about them, my mother said. My father shrugged. We'll just be a minute. She glanced at the toll booths. Hers was fifth in a row of 10. Snow-laden trucks were sliding up to the booths at 30 miles an hour, floating on ice and sometimes missing the stop. She held out her palm, and in an instant the flakes falling on it became water. She said, well, we could carry them. He checked his watch. Leave them here. She looked at me and said, stay in the car and shut the door. I watched them walk to the edge of the highway and grab hands. They stood and waited for several minutes while trucks passed. Then they ran across the first lane, paused on the first toll island, and dashed across again. Later that night, I asked my mother what had happened, and she said it wasn't my business. But after I asked her a fourth time, she told me. The woman was still there. Sure, I remember you, she said. You gave me this. She held it up. Just then, a blue sedan slid into the stall. My parents hurried up onto the platform behind the booth, a raised nub, and squished themselves against the booth's inside metal side. I have a dollar now, my mother said, when the sedan was gone. This is my husband, my father said. Hello, I'm Bill. In his most charming, glad-to-meet-you voice, the woman nodded. I came to get my coin back, my mother said. She held out a token. The woman shook her head. This coin belongs to me. It's my coin, my mother said. You gave it to me, the woman said, and now it's mine. I took it out of the box, she pointed to a cardboard box on a metal counter, and I replaced it with my own dollar. A car veered into the stall. My parents climbed back onto the nub. More cars followed. When they stepped down, my father had to shout to be heard above the traffic. I didn't give it to you, she said. I left it with you for safekeeping. The woman told my parents to leave. She said she wasn't a fool. She knew the coin was worth money. She could tell because it looked old. She called a friend who knew about coins, and the friend had said it sounded valuable, perhaps very. My mother nodded. Then she begged. The coin was the only thing she had of her mother's, she said, and her mother had died when she was 9. It was why she'd kept it all these years. Yes, it was worth something, but it was sentimental to her. It was her memory, really, of her mother. My father rubbed his nose. It's not worth much, he said. The woman gestured my parents back onto the nub. Then she opened a panel in the booth and spoke to them through it while she serviced cars. Her own mother was not alive, of course, she said. Her own mother had died years ago. She herself was 62 and worked in a toll booth. She had arthritis and shingles, not to mention other things. She shrugged and said she was getting it appraised by a dealer and selling it. They'd been at the booth for a half an hour. The sky was dark. If they didn't leave now, the woman said, she'd call the police. My mother leaned forward. It's worth 20 grand, she said. The woman blinked and waved my mother away. When they got back to the lot, they found that we were gone. My father was enraged. He was overdue on his emergency pass, but he proposed a plan. My mother agreed to his plan. She started walking north along the shoulder looking for us. But then she turned into the woods. She felt sure that wandering into them was something I might have done. It was, but it was equally something she herself might have done. There were an infinite number of places to enter the forest, which stretched darkly, politely on both sides of the road. It was overwhelming, but also irresistible. My mother was compelled, perhaps, by the hopelessness of the task. Of course, footprints would have been the thing to look for, but the snow was falling thickly and had already left 2 inches on top of the rabbit, and she decided that it had covered our tracks. She walked into the forest until she could no longer hear the cars on the highway and sat down. A tree, a handsome green pine, immediately dropped a load of snow on her head. She brushed it off. Her jeans grew wet. The forest said, shh, shh. And the pines leaned to and fro in the wind. 30 more minutes passed. My father strode back and forth by the toll booths looking for my mother. He was unable to find her tracks in the dark. He shouted her name and swore a lot. When he finally saw her footprints, he followed them a quarter mile into the woods and found her sitting covered in snow under the spruce. Get up, he said. I can't. Get up. It's too late, she said. They're gone. We've lost them, and it's my fault. I never should have left them in the car. He was a fool. But he was not a fool. He saw that she was pining for the coin. He slapped her. We're looking for the girls, he said. They trudged back to the car. They opened the choke, pumped the gas, and turned the car on. Then they got out the brush and the scraper and brushed off the snow and scraped off the ice and got in. After my parents had left, I'd unbuckled my sister and pulled her from the car. I'd walked us south along the shoulder towards McDonald's. We'd gone about 30 feet when a white sedan pulled over. The door opened and a woman in a burgundy coat stepped out. She asked me where our parents were. My sister began to cry. I said they'd gone on an errand and saw in the woman's face that she thought we'd been abandoned. She asked me where my parents' vehicle was. I walked her to it. When she saw the rabbit with its mismatched fenders, one orange, one blue, and rusty frame, I saw that she thought they'd left the car behind, too. She squatted down there in the lot and brought her large white face close to mine. She asked if I was hungry. I nodded. Her brow wrinkled. She asked if my sister and I had eaten that day at all. We'd had meatloaf right before leaving home, but for some reason, when I looked at her long burgundy coat, my mouth twitched and I said, "Just crackers." At McDonald's, I ate 2 boxes of chicken McNuggets and 6 containers of sweet and sour sauce and drank 2 orange drinks. My sister was too senseless with sorrow to eat her own. And the woman's husband, Mr. Swenside, had to walk around the restaurant bouncing her up and down in his arms. Mrs. Swenside watched me eat. Then she told me to put on my coat. By the time my parents reached the police station, Mrs. Swenside had played 3 sets of Connect Four with me and was going on a 4th. She'd let me win 2 and had once won herself. She'd also described her house on the sea where, she'd suggested, we might stay temporarily. I don't know what my parents said when they arrived. Eventually, a sergeant must have shoved a thumb toward the lounge in the back. My father made some stiff gestures toward gratitude at first. "Glad you found them. Thanks for bringing them here." Which were answered by the Swensides, "The least we could do on a day like this, 20 degrees. That's without the wind chill, dear. With the wind chill, it's 20 below. And interrupted by my father's, "For Christ's sake." Then various accusations came out. "Stole our children. We were 10 feet away. Left them alone for 5 minutes. More like 20, I'd say. We waited by your rabbit. You were nowhere in sight. What kind of parent?" This was Mr. Swenside, in whose arms I was being squeezed. "These babies, nothing but crackers for a week." At which point, the accumulated joy of the 2 boxes of chicken nuggets, 6 packets of sweet and sour sauce, and 2 orange drinks overcame me, and I threw up in his lap. "Christ," he said, and shoved me away. Mrs. Swenside extended her arms somewhat gingerly, produced a tissue, and wiped my mouth. "The poor dear," she said. "No wonder, no protein in weeks. She can't digest it anymore." My father looked very small next to Mr. Swenside, and perhaps because of this was standing far away from him near the door. My mother knelt down. Her hair hung in wild curls. Her eyes were dark brown with spots of gold, like stars drowning in a muddy pond. She said, "Tell the lady you lied." I took a look at Mrs. Swenside. Her face expressed disappointment. Her white hair was coiled high on her head. In the press of her maple lips, which she'd colored in my presence, there was a tremor. I saw a snobbish pity in her eyes. I thought of the green train with working lights and 3 speeds that I admired 2 Christmases running in the Sears catalog, and I felt I'd get this one from Mrs. Swenside. "You're stupid," I told her. My mother made me apologize, and I did. Mrs. Swenside said that she should have known better than to pick up a strange child from the highway. On the way back to the base, my parents laughed about the whole fiasco. They did not mention the coin. My father particularly enjoyed the fact that I'd gotten sick on Mr. Swenside and said more than once, he was pretty surprised, as if my dinner's ejection had been a swift and patriotic strike in his defense. But when we reached the base, my mother grew quiet. My father got out of the car and walked around to the driver's side. "Okay," he said. She looked into the dark. Snow was falling thickly on the windshield, through which the lights along the barbed wire fence twinkled, exotic and smeared. "You can't stay here," he said. She mentioned that she'd hoped he would come home. She said that he could say it was an emergency. It's not an emergency, he said. She put the car in gear. The shift stuck, and she did it a second time. Drive slow, he said. We did. The snow came down in gusts, like ghosts slapping themselves against the car, and I knew we would die. When we reached the bottom of our mountain, it was past midnight. Before the steep hill to our house was a flat stretch of 50 feet. My mother stopped the rabbit, gunned the engine, and hoped the momentum would take us up. On the fifth try, it did. When she got to our driveway, she pulled hard to the right. The car swung into the drive, and its wheels spun, then spun again. She got out and got my sister out. Put your hat and mittens on, she said. The snow had stopped. Around us was the world I knew well. My grandmother's house at the midpoint of the mountain, the road climbing up into the woods, and the little mountain behind, all covered in white. Our driveway was a perfect slide of ice. I took a step and fell. Got up, fell again. I decided to crawl. My mother laughed at me. But after falling a few times, she hooked my sister under an arm and crawled too. When we rounded the bend, I saw our house far ahead. She'd left a lamp on. And the black vigil of trees at the field's edge. At the top of the sky was the moon. The moon, I said. Ooh! It was full, or almost full, like a lumpy opal or a nice fake pearl. I howled. The idea had appeal. The forest seemed dark and deadly, the house worse, as if it might be concealing something upstairs, which would wait until the lights went out to strike. But as a wolf, I was safe. I howled, and my mother howled obligingly, and my sister made a silly woo-woo noise. We heard a weak bark from the trees. Hurry up, my mother said. The yip came again. It was a coyote, the one that skulked by the wood's edge in late afternoon. But I felt a thrill in my loins as when I had to pee. I howled. Shut up, my mother said. We reached the house. She turned on more lights. I saw a maudlin tear in her eye. You shut up, I said. I began to imagine that it wasn't too late to find Mrs. Swenside, and I'd tell her I'd changed my mind. But why did my mother cry? Undoubtedly for the 20 grand. But also, perhaps, for other things, such as all the things 20 grand could have bought. The house in Portsmouth, the garage, or a new job for my father. Or perhaps for her dead mother, the coin, her someday career. When my father came home a few days later, he was unusually solicitous for several days. Then one afternoon, in the middle of ironing a shirt, my mother paused and said, I miss my mother's coin. And my father turned from the other room and said, Then you shouldn't have spent it.
Jane Curtin read 20 Grand by Rebecca Curtis. After a short break, we'll be back with this year's prize-winning story. You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide. From PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. Each year at Symphony Space, we conduct the Stella Kupferberg Memorial Short Story Award Contest, granting a prize and inclusion in this series to the winning story. This past year's winner, from among hundreds of entries received by our committee of judges, was written by Anne DeMarkin, a young writer and filmmaker from Washington State. She was delighted to fly east to Symphony Space to hear her story, which is entitled Best Western, read on the closing night of our spring season by the wonderful Laura Esterman.
I think about how, if we had an accident right now, chances are good my mom would die. She slipped off the safety belt shoulder strap and has turned to face me in her sleep. She has her linty fleece pullover bunched up against the passenger window as a pillow. Her eyebrows are lifted high and her mouth frowns deeply. She looks impressed or offended. I swerve to avoid the black rind of a retread tire. She grunts and wakes up, but hardly shifts. After a while, she sits up and rummages in her huge purse for her Ziploc baggies. She packed snacks this morning. Wheat thins, baby carrots, string cheese, apple slices. We're not speaking, so. She holds out an open bag without saying anything. I shake my head. I can't stand the smell of food stored in plastic. I've always hated it. The smell now brings back all the sack lunches I ever threw away. I roll down the window a couple inches to get some air. My mom follows my example and does the same. If I were to roll my window back up, she would roll hers back up. The cross draft makes the mat in the back seat flap around noisily. We don't need the map, but my mom likes to keep track of where we are. A long time ago, she used a yellow highlighter to mark our route, and we always go the same way. My hair whips around and gets caught between my eyes and my sunglasses. I push my sunglasses up on my head like a headband. Without them, I see just how disappointing the familiar landscape is. Words appear in the air above my head. Irritation, desperation, station wagon, piano. My theory is that I see words when I think them because of Sesame Street. They appear in Helvetica bold. Sometimes there are spaces between the syllables. Put your seatbelt back on, I say. It is another 2 hours before we pull into the parking lot of the Best Western Inn in Lone Pine. I'm not at all tired, but my mom loves this Best Western and has made reservations for a first-floor room. When we check in, she recounts for the desk clerk the entire history of our Lone Pine stopovers and tells him the circumstances of our trip this time. Mom, I say to my mom. I'm sorry, I say to the clerk. No, he says, I'm sorry for your loss. But I'm glad you mentioned it. I can give you the bereavement discount. He is wearing a red blazer that is too big for him. He is quite delicate for a man. The name tag on the pocket says Ando Honda. First, I have to remind myself that Honda is a name, not just a car. Then, it takes me a few times reading it back and forth to be sure it isn't a palindrome. I wonder whether he grew up here. Are there many Japanese people in Lone Pine? The Manzanar War Relocation Center isn't far from here, where Japanese Americans were interned during World War II. From the road, it is just a section of fence and a memorial plaque. We stopped to read it once. Meanwhile, my mom says, oh, I didn't know Best Western did that. I would never ask. He smiles reassuringly, apparently not bothered by her at all. He clicks away at a computer terminal that is built into the counter, calmly navigating whatever display of blank fields and codes it presents. The keys sound like the keys of an old computer, like the kind we learned to do basic programming on in junior high. The screens were dark gray, with sea-green characters. He prints a receipt and puts it on the counter. This is our easy checkout service. In the morning, you can get up and go. Just sign here and fill in your license plate and the color and make of your car. My mom can't remember the license plate number because they recently issued her a new one. While she searches for her reading glasses in her purse, I go outside and check, saying the numbers and letters over and over to myself. And then out loud, once I get back to the counter, 390ZMB4. She writes it in the space provided. When she is nervous, my mom makes noises in her throat and grimaces as if she is bearing down on pain. But she has lovely handwriting. Even her numbers are nice. "Is that right?" she says, looking up at the clerk. "You're all set," he says. "Enjoy your stay." "Thank you, Ando," she says. We pull the car around to the side of the building and back into the parking space that goes with our room door. As we unpack the car, and then when we are having dinner across the parking lot at the Copper Kettle restaurant, I can't stop hearing the license plate number in my head. I hear it in my own voice over and over and see it. The 3 is spring green, the 9 is red, and the 4 is grass green. The 0 and the letters are black. Back at the motel, I make my mom cry when I bring up the piano again. "I'm going swimming," I say. I didn't pack a swimsuit, so I put on a t-shirt over my underwear and bra. The pool is between the motel and the Copper Kettle, surrounded by a low wrought iron fence that separates it from the parking lot. The sky and the pool are about equally luminous. In between, it is dark and silhouetted, the low blocks of buildings, the high, ragged edge of the mountains, the shapes of palm trees and cottonwoods, of small billboards and high-tension power lines. There is the moon. Floating on my back, I realize that I have stopped repeating the license plate number. Now my mind is saying over and over, "Ando Honda." Instead of hearing it in my voice, I hear it in his voice. "Ando Honda, Ando Honda, Ando Honda." What if we fell in love and got married and we lived here in Lone Pine? I could get a job at the Copper Kettle. I walk back along the sidewalk, barefoot, making hardly any noise. Televisions flicker blue behind the closed curtains of some of the other motel rooms. My mom has left the bathroom light on so that I can see. I can tell she is awake, but I pretend that I have to be very quiet so that she will pretend to be asleep and not say anything to me. I go into the bathroom and close the door. I turn on the shower and peel off my wet t-shirt and underwear and bra and leave them on the floor as if I am a teenager. In the shower, I use the motel shampoo and conditioner and unwrap the little cake of almond-scented soap. The air is so dry, I hardly have to towel off. I wrap one towel around my body and twist one around my head, the way my mom used to. Like Mata Hari. I shake out my wet clothes and hang them over the shower curtain rod. Before turning out the light, I open the door a crack and take one last look at the room so that I can find my way without bumping into anything. The room is stuffy, hot. I peel back the stiff, quilted bedspread and foam velour blanket and lie naked between just the sheets. It feels surprisingly luxurious, and I remember the fun and adventure of staying in a motel when I was a girl. This motel. My mom is too quiet to be asleep. I can almost hear her open eyes looking up toward the ceiling. The darkness is nearly complete. I close my eyes. I'm in that first part of sleep that is like a boat ramp sloping down into water deep enough for dreams when she says, "We'll never come here again." It's true, we probably won't. Now. I open my eyes. My nose stings with tears. I tell myself that it isn't my job to turn this into a nice memory. But I feel bad about making an issue out of the piano, even though I am right about it. I try to think of something I can say that is both nice and true. A big truck pulls up outside our room, and for a minute, its headlight shines so brightly on the white vinyl lining of our curtains, leaking in around the edges. It is as if a diesel-powered UFO has landed in the parking lot. Then they cut the engine, and a second later, the lights, and we listen to the truck doors open and close, and to the low voices of a man and a woman. The door of the room next to ours opens and closes, and then we can't hear anything more. I'll miss it, I say. I hear her turn over on her side in her bed so that she is facing me in the darkness. We aren't that far apart, just a nightstand's width. I stretch my arm out so that my hand is suspended in the space between our beds. I can see it in the faint red glow of the radio alarm clock. I hear the sound of her sliding her hand across the sheets and can just see it there at the edge of her bed. She waggles her fingers. I waggle my fingers. It is like catching a blown kiss. The distance is part of the sweetness. In the morning, we get up when it is still dark. We make coffee in the room and decide to skip the copper kettle. We'll eat down the road. On our way out of town, the sky stretches out ahead of us, brighter than the road. It looks like a river running between the long, dark banks of the Sierra and Inyo ranges. It is almost white in the east and pale purple in the west. The moon sank hours ago, but there is still a few bright stars.
Laura Esterman read Anne DeMarkin's prize-winning story, Best Western. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague, and our production assistant is Miranda Schaefer. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Our theme music is Roger Calloway's Come to the Meadow. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of The Best American Short Stories, edited in 2008 by Salman Rushdie, and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, and on the web at bn.com. Additional support is provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, Budget Travel, the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, the New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Henry Nias Foundation, and the Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund of the New York Community Trust. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York, and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.